You are all weirdos.
Weird science is the revolution. Weird science is the revolution.
Welcome all you weirdos, non-speaking carbonadium-dependent mutants, and everyone who remembers when there were four versions of Mr. Sinister running around. It is time for your 92nd Weird Dose of X, the immune member of your Weird Science family. I am your always-winning host, Jason, broadcasting as ever from the Wrong Turn Studio, high atop stately Weird Science Tower. And here with me is a man who would never make a deal with the devil just to become a subroutine, my pal Ruben. Hey Ruben, how the heck are you today?
Hey, doing pretty good. Glad to be here and talking about books that I enjoy.
Wow, that's a little bit of a spoiler going ahead, isn't it? Yeah, it is a Kieran Gillen week, and we are kind of simps for Kieran Gillen, so no surprise, I think. We haven't discussed this issue, but I'm pretty sure we are both going to enjoy this Rise of the Powers of X book. Well, we are losing Sinisters left and right now, aren't we? We've got a couple down. Who's left? We've got Enigma, of course. Mother Righteous is still hanging out in that egg. And I guess Orbis Stellaris is still kicking around somewhere, right? What is he up to these days?
Orbis Stellaris? I don't know. That's a good question. I know in the future he... Wasn't he involved in the Ascendancy attempt? That was like plus 10 years. And then I guess he was involved in taking down Mother Righteous, but...
Right. He kind of popped in with his brother, Dr. Stasis there to take out Mother Righteous. And
yeah.
Yeah, it didn't work out so well for Mother Righteous. So yeah, we are certainly kind of starting to run out of Nathaniel Essex's, which is probably the plan. Well, we do have a few small bits of news this week. We've learned that Wolverine number 50 will be oversized, and by oversized, I mean it'll cost $8. Issue 50 will contain the final chapter of the Sabretooth War, naturally, and also some additional short stories, including one by Larry Hama and another by Ben Percy. So they're going to fill it out, you know, end of an era kind of a thing. Wolverine number 50 goes on sale May 22nd. You looking forward to a Larry Hama Wolverine story?
Maybe. I don't know. I have a hard time thinking of Larry Hama as anyone other than the G.I. Joe guy. Uh-huh. So he has a certain style of writing, and it's not, I wouldn't call it action-packed. It seems like it'll be a big departure from, you know, what we've been getting lately. But
he's been doing that. I guess it finished up that Madripoor Knights story with Wolverine.
Yeah, and I haven't been reading any of that, so... Maybe somebody has an opinion based on that.
And I'm curious if we'll get any kind of a peek forward in that book, or it'll be completely just a look backwards, or will we get any hints about the From the Ashes era, you know, what Wolverine will be up to? We'll have to wait and see. Speaking of Wolverine, Logan does appear in this past week's Daredevil number 7 by Saladin Ahmed. Nothing for Koa relevant. Logan gets possessed by a demon and has a fight with Daredevil. Some really nice Aaron Cooter art, though. So if you're looking for a classic Wolverine, Daredevil, Brawl. There's some good stuff over there. Are you reading Daredevil these days?
No. I was trying to read the last era, and I enjoyed it, but for whatever reason, I just never really got into it. Daredevil's weird. Like, I liked the TV show, but I just have never been that excited about the comics.
Saladin Ahmed's doing a Seven Deadly Sins riff, where, you know, Matt was in hell, he came back out of hell, and it turns out these Seven Deadly Sins demons followed him and are kind of possessing people around him. So this time it seemed like you'd think naturally that Logan would get possessed by rage, but it turns out towards the end that it was the demon of lust that was possessing Logan. Well, it was lust for violence, so nothing too sketchy. Moving on, I did read Cable number 3 this week. Continues to be, you know, kind of just okay. Nothing wrong with it, but not really my thing. Continues to have zero to do with the ongoing Krakoa story. The big cliffhanger this week. Ruben, have you read Cable number 3 before I spoil it for you?
No, go for it. Spoil it. Okay. But I had that on the list of things to do, and I just didn't get to it.
Well, here's what happened. So they're continuing to kind of clean up this whole Neocracy thing with old Nathan really, you know, hot to kill anybody at all involved, and young Nate saying, yeah, they kind of seem like they might be okay people. Maybe this is going too far. And at the very last panel of the whole issue, young Cable gets totally fed up, and he shoots old Cable. Which, of course, is not the first time that Cable has kind of sort of murdered himself, right?
Yeah.
So we're back to that. I don't know if this is Baby Nissa. He's got to be aware of that. Maybe this is an intentional homage, because that happened in Jerry Duggan and Phil Noto's Cable series in 2021. And that was also in issue number 3 of that series. So maybe intentional.
We'll assume that it was.
Could be. Give him the benefit of the doubt. And there's only one more issue left. It's a 4-issue series. And both Cables appear on the cover of the next issue, which may or may not mean anything. So maybe he's not really killing the old guy, or maybe they're just trying to clean up the whole Cable situation, have only one Cable going forward as we head into the From the Ashes era. Could go either way.
Yeah, I hope so.
I do enjoy the dynamic between the two of them. I like the young Nate and old Nathan. It's pretty good. So we'll see if that goes ahead or if we're ending that. We had an announcement from Tom Brevoort in his newsletter. He revealed that Jed McKay's X-Men and Gail Simone's Uncanny are each going to release 18 issues in their first 12 months. So they really want to push these books out. They want to get people to buy as many of them as they can. And the first thing that I thought of was they're really pushing the launch artists for these books, right? We've got Ryan Stegman on X-Men, David Marquez on Uncanny. Out of the 36 issues in the first 12 months, how many of those issues do you think will be drawn by these big name artists that they're pushing at the launch? Half, maybe?
I'd say a quarter. I have a feeling there's going to be some sort of like every 2 weeks thing to get us to the 18.
Well, I think the plan is that any given month, there's going to be 3 issues of these 2 books, and they'll alternate, you know, which book is double shipping in January, then the other one will double ship in February, and back and forth like that. So I think that's the plan. How long that holds up, who knows? More From the Ashes news. We did hear that Betsy Britton and Rachel Summers are going to have their own book in the new era, which will be different from the Phoenix book that's already announced. Now, I swear that I originally read that this Rachel and Betsy book will continue to be written by Teenie Howard, but when I looked up news sources to confirm that for my notes, I can't find any, so maybe I made that up. But it would be pretty wild, wouldn't it, if the only writer continuing his story onward into the next era is Teenie Howard? Not really a name you would say, oh, that's when I think of the Raccoon era, that's really the one who's you know, driving the ship. But, oh, well.
Yeah, that's a series that I just really didn't enjoy in any sort of stretch.
Yeah, that whole saga has been through several series, and really ever since the first one that led into X of Swords, I really haven't been keeping up with the happenings there.
Teenie has fans, though, so you know what? I mean, it's true. It's one of those things where it's like, maybe not for me, but somebody's getting some joy out of it, so I will just continue to stay away from that book and let the people
If you like it, enjoy it. That's fine. And finally, I have watched the first 3 episodes now of X-Men 97, that Disney Plus animated show, and it's all right.
It's all right.
The first thing I noticed is it moves really fast. It's just using up storylines left and right.
Yeah. My take on the third issue episode, I enjoyed the first two. The third one felt a little too compressed. I get that they're doing the 90s style storytelling where, you know, people may or may not be watching it week to week. So you got to tell a whole story in one episode, but the stuff that happens, I guess I'm trying to not spoil it. The stuff that happens in it, I think, is probably better in long form than just, you know, 30 minutes.
Yeah. And well, maybe I'll spoil a couple things. We know Jean Grey gets cloned. I mean, we've been discussing her clones here on this show forever, so no surprises there. And the whole cloning and reveal of the clone and the birth of Cable and Cable going to the future, that gets done in like 5 minutes. And at the same time, they're doing a Storm life-death sort of thing, except it's Mr. Sinister who took her powers and not Forge. And it's just really, really quick. So I guess the idea is that, hey, if you're enjoying that show and these plot lines seem like fun, maybe go look up the comics. And I think they're even better over there. But, you know, things like complicated plots, deep characterization, not really happening so much in the show. I would call it, the action looks really nice. It's cool to see these characters moving around and using their powers and, you know, actual moving around animation. So it's a perfectly adequate show to have on while folding laundry. I always need a good laundry folding show, and I think this is mine.
Yeah, I'm still enjoying watching it with the wife, and so that's probably the biggest thing for me. And then I can, you know, answer her questions about, you know, how that is or is not different than the comics to the extent she cares to ask.
Yeah, nobody in the house is interested in watching any of this stuff with me. This is all my, after everybody else goes to bed, I'm doing laundry, I'm doing whatever. That's when I put on my anime and now my X-Men cartoons.
Yeah. I'm sure she's humoring me, by the way. She probably doesn't give a rat's ass about any of this, but I'll take what I can get.
I've been married for 25 years now, and I think the humoring kind of starts to, you know, wear away a little bit after the first 2 decades. Just a little hint for all you newly married people out there.
That's, yeah. Okay. We're up to 10, so I'm still in the honeymoon, right?
Absolutely. Keep it going. Well, that's enough of our marriage advice segment. We're going to move on to the actual books of this week. And those books are, I don't think I've listed them yet, so I got to scroll up. The books we're going to talk about this week are X-Force number 50, Rise of the Powers of X number 3, and Wolverine number 46. And we are going to start off with, and now I scroll back down, to Rise of the Powers of X number 3 of 5, The X-Life of Moira. That's EX X-Life for some reason. I don't know. They always go with the X like the letter, but this one, I guess, Kieran Gillen wants to emphasize it's the former life of Moira. It is written, of course, by Kieran Gillen, art by R.B. Silva, colors by David Curiel, letters by Clayton Cowles, design by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. So, this was a pretty cool book again. We've got a couple things going on, and it's really the cover I thought was terrific. I don't, you know, once in a while we talk about the cover, but this one really caught my attention. What did you think of this? Do you can you picture this cover in your mind, or if you got it in front of you?
Yeah, I looked at it just a second ago. It's definitely striking. And is this a homage cover to? I know it's an homage to like the Hickman, you know, most important scene in X-Men.
That whole conversation lore on the park bench.
Yeah, but was that a cover in the Hux Pox era books as well?
I don't think it was a cover. I don't remember it being a cover. I do like this because you see Moira, and this in this cover, it is the, you know, the Moira of the grown-up Moira who met with Professor X there sitting on the bench, and it's like a first person shooter view. Professor X holding this particular looking gun and pointing at a very shocked looking Moira. So it doesn't happen exactly like that in the book, but Kieran Gillen says in his newsletter that the reason they changed it was, quote, "You can't have someone pointing a gun at a 13-year-old on a cover for F's sake," which, good point, Kieran. That was some good judgment there.
Yeah.
I do also love that in a throwback move, the main covers of this whole series have been done by the same artist and colorist who do the interiors, R.B. Silva, David Curiel. So that's always nice. I mean, for me, that's a really old school kind of thing where these days I don't even expect it to be.
It doesn't look anything like the cover.
It's the same artist.
Yeah.
So that's nice. And while I'm on these artists, Silva, Curiel, I got to say right up front, the art here, really fantastic. Top tier.
Yes.
Each of the different locations, a distinct, appropriate look, different color palette. For instance, the young Moira scene, all these soft, glowy pastels indicating springtime and beginnings and youth, which is certainly appropriate for the scene from childhood, but also a real contrast with Xavier's mission here, which is, you know, deadly serious. So the art here is really some of the best I've seen in a long time. Am I getting too excited about this, or is this really as good as I think it is?
It's very good. I don't know if I'd say best that I've seen, but it definitely looks important. It makes the book feel like a big event book, which it is, right?
Yeah.
And so as I read it, it just felt cinematic. Everything about it, just as you say, the art.
That's a good word, yeah.
The colors are great, but also it feels like a big sci-fi thriller with important things happening.
I think it's part of it is just the way that Kieran Gillen paces the pages and the panels. It, you can feel that tension cranking up and cranking up and cranking up. And some other books we've complained about, oh, things just kind of happen out of nowhere and they feel like they deflate all that feeling of tension. Gillen knows how to do it right.
Yeah, so I was definitely sucked in. And then when I finished it, I was like, oh, man, I want let's keep the story going. I don't want to take a break, which is a good sign, right?
It is an excellent sign, yeah. So in this issue, Xavier and Moira do have a talk. Xavier is an adult. He looks like an adult. Moira is intellectually an adult, but she looks like a child. She hasn't had her mutant awakening yet in this life. That's coming later today. But she does remember lives 1 through 9, and she already has major plans for this 10th one, right? All that whole bring all the two sides together, Magneto and Xavier and Krakoa. She already has this plan in her head. Now, Xavier knows about that plan, but he also knows how that plan is going to turn out, and that's what he's here to avert. So right up front, this whole setup of these two old friends who know different things and have different ideas of the best way to move forward is really pretty amazing.
Yeah, I thought the dynamic was really interesting because, you know, he's here on his mission, but you've got Moira who's like, I've known you longer than you know yourself, which is a wild concept, right?
True, yeah.
And then at the same time, it's not like all one-sided power dynamic because what she doesn't know is what happens over the next, you know, 10 years, which is what he does know. So it's an interesting informational conversation that they're having.
Yeah, it's kind of a dramatic irony situation where we, the readers, know more than the characters, but they also know more than each other in different ways. So it's a lot of fun to think about. So Xavier does plan on killing young Moira, but he wants to explain himself first, which is a very Charles Xavier thing to do, right?
I know. I was like, yeah. I think it's completely consistent with the characterization of the character, but at the same time, I was like, come on, Charles. Like, you're here to kill a kid. Like, you're not going to redeem yourself with justifying it to her, right? So that she accepts that she's going to be gunned down. And then she eventually runs off, right? So I was like, yeah, you got to feel like a total louse.
He wants to have things both ways. He wants to do the necessary, painful, kind of evil things. It's necessary. I got to do it. Yeah. But first, he wants his victim to know just how much it hurts him personally to do the thing, right?
Yes, yes.
Come on, Charles.
Total ego maniac there. And the person getting killed is not going to care, man. Like, right. Like you're the threat, right? They're not going to be like, oh, I get it. Great. Take me out.
I agree. You should kill me. Yes. I feel bad for you, Charles. Here, let me do it. No, that's not going to happen. I mean, compare and contrast this to, like, Beast, right?
Yeah.
He just does the thing. He would not explain why he feels bad. He just does what he has to do, what he thinks he has to do. He doesn't really care about his victims feeling bad.
Plus, he has like such a terrifying power, right? His mental powers. He even uses them to like stop her as she's running away. But he could do more than that, right? So it's weird. Like maybe it's his id sabotaging him or something. Or am I using the right term? Maybe it's ego. Anyways, it feels like he must be conflicted internally too, right? Because he doesn't just, I mean, he could just give her an aneurysm. Mm-hmm. And that would be it.
I think
very simple.
That's true. I think more than being actually conflicted, I really think he's playing a part, like for himself and for others. He's really enacting this martyr complex of, oh, I'm doing the hard thing and it hurts me so much.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about Moira, too. I mean, more and more, I see her as a tragic figure. She has gotten to live more days than any actual human being in history, right? 9+ lives worth, even though some of them have been shorter than others. And all she really cares about is getting to live even more. I mean, speaking of seven deadly sins, this is almost like a gluttony situation.
Yeah.
And yet, how much can we blame a person for not wanting to truly die if she thinks, hey, I've never had to die before for real. Why should I start now?
Yeah.
So you can kind of see where she's coming from, too. In this issue, Moira says, I don't want to die. I want to live. I'm trapped. And Xavier's answer is, we're all trapped, Moira. To be human is to be trapped. You were a fool to think that being immune to change that, and you convinced us all to be fools. Damn you and damn me. Which is deeper than I expected from a comic book, really. You know? That's really something.
Yeah.
I mean, from this perspective, all of Krakoa was Moira dragging the rest of mutantdom into her obsession with immortality. But that's the fundamental promise of Krakoa, that no mutant ever needs to really die. And Xavier and Magneto and Apocalypse, damn near every other mutant, bought into that false promise. And that's what caused the situation there and now. Which, I don't know if that was Hickman's plan from the beginning, but it works really well as a, you know, as a theme, as an arc. Really fantastic.
Yeah, and as a criticism for why Krakoa is not a real nation, right? Like, it's... Mm-hmm. Strips away humanity because it takes away a fundamental characteristic, which people have said, right? Like, it just from a storytelling perspective, it also removes drama from the stories. But it is an interesting idea of, and we dealt with some of that in the Nightcrawler type books, right? Where they were questioning, like, the way you would live your life changing
what
if
does
you
it mean now,
knew yes. that you actually never died.
Yes. And I think that that's terrific because those criticisms were valid, and having them taken into the story and kind of shows that, hey, we knew that all along. That was part of the story we're trying to tell. Whether or not it was the story all along, it makes sense from the end that it is. Now, right before Xavier is about to shoot, young Moira asks, quote, isn't there another way forward, a kinder way? And Xavier answers, quote, this is the kindest way available to us. The other path is worse. So he even mentions there's another path, and we're going to come back to that other path, and we're going to come back to Moira and Xavier, but right now we're going to pop over inside No Place X to see what the rest of that crew's up to. And they're kind of in trouble. Enigma has found them and has sent those skull-faced Stark Sentinels after them, which means that Rasputin is outside the No Place fighting him off, while Rachel and Sinister Doug work on the inside to keep the place intact and to be ready to get the heck out of there as soon as the professor returns. I did laugh when Mother Righteous offered to help out. You know, hey, just let me out, and you know, I can fix this right away.
Yeah.
They do not take her up on her offer. Doug calls her a, quote, sinister spawn liar, which is what we in the industry call irony, because
yes, Doug really is.
That was a wonderful little line. I like that a lot. Another nice thing here about the fight is that these Sentinels really feel dangerous.
Yeah. Right?
We think that these people are at risk, and we've complained about these Sentinels being chumps for months now, so we should really point it out, too, when it's done right. And here they're done very well.
Yeah, once again, I was just thinking, why are these Sentinels here not kicking Iron Man's butt in Australia?
I mean, these are the Enigma-created skull-faced Sentinels.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
the better versions.
It's a different...
I guess you're right. You're a different villain, different leader. Kind of
Yeah. So one of these Sentinel hands does get into the no place, is about to grab Doug or maybe blast him with a hand blaster thing. Not exactly sure. And as a last-ditch effort to save himself, Doug says, activate failsafe, untouchable. And again, not sure exactly what happened here, but I think this is Sinister Doug activating the genetically implanted mutant ability of Unus the Untouchable.
Yeah, that's how I read it.
Which combines two things Sinister's been obsessed with all through this era, right? He loves failsafes, and he loves Unus genes. He's used Unus all over the place. I mean, we haven't actually seen Unus on panel, I think, since X of Swords. But we had the Unus sphere and the Sinister timeline. We've had just Unus everything. He just loves those genes. So that was terrific. Now, using this ability is great for Doug, except that using the ability makes his eyes go white and puts the Sinister diamond on his forehead for everybody to see, specifically for Rasputin to see. And she does not like Mr. Sinister. And for good reason, right? I mean, what was their history?
Yeah, I mean, basically, he convinced her to be his enforcer in a Sinister timeline, and then betrayed her in the end. Yeah, for centuries.
Betrayed her, and she remembers that whole timeline. She's really the only one who fully remembers that. She lived through it, and she got transported to this timeline through, was it Mother Righteous shenanigans?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, Righteous brought her back so that she would specifically go after Diamond Sinister.
Right. So, naturally, Rasputin flips out. Once she sees that Doug is Sinister, she kind of maybe too quickly jumps to the conclusion that Xavier isn't just there to chat with Moira, but he's going to kill her, which is the correct conclusion, but I'm not quite sure that she would get there quite that quickly. Am I being a little too critical here, you think, or is that just too convenient?
It didn't bother me at all. I actually thought this was intelligent Rasputin, which is so different than the one we've seen in Duggan's storyline. But this is the one I would have expected, right? Like, she had hundreds to thousands of years of life experience. I wouldn't imagine her being a dope when she comes back. And especially, I mean, it's not that weird, right? You saw Doug and Xavier talking about plans, right? It'd be like, okay, well, if Doug is Sinister, then obviously Sinister is.
Yeah, and I guess Doug did talk about, oh, maybe you should just let me go back and kill her.
Yeah.
So I guess it has been bandied about. So yeah, I'm all right with that. I could use maybe one more dialogue balloon linking the seeing to the action, but it's fine. So Rasputin runs off through that diamond-shaped portal to go stop Xavier. Again, should have been a clue. Now we've rejoined Xavier's child murder plan already in progress. Rasputin runs in, guns blazing, forcing Xavier to defend himself, allowing Moira to temporarily run away. He throws down a handful of small red diamonds that grow into sinister Jamie Madrox creatures, which that's a weird little detail to put in. It's kind of just needed something for Rasputin to fight for a minute. And they look cool enough, but they kind of come out of nowhere and they're going to disappear into nowhere. So a bit of a throwaway little weapon there from Xavier. But it was all right.
I like that they were like in little diamond pills that he threw to the ground. I thought that was a cool little detail.
True. And they all have red diamonds on their forehead. And Rasputin's going to happy to kill anybody that has a red diamond on his forehead. So
that
works out all right. So Xavier is once again about to shoot Moira. And this time Rachel chimes in telepathically from the no place. Rachel doesn't seem to much care about the whole child murder thing. She just doesn't want Krakoa to be wiped away. Go ahead.
I was just saying it's kind of weird that she wasn't so concerned about that, but she's from a bleak future as well, so maybe that makes sense.
Yeah, she really wants Krakoa to still exist, because remember, the plan is that if you kill Moira here at the beginning of this life, then she never gets together with Charles and Magneto, and Krakoa just never happens. Which should, in theory, mean that Enigma never happens. Time travel causality, who knows if that really works, but we're not going to find out because that's not going to happen. We do get a series of Xavier face panels, once again recalling that bench scene from House of X, the one where he first, you know, Krakoa dawned on him, where he got that mental download from Moira. And he relents. He's not going to kill young Moira. He's going to turn to plan number 3 instead. Remember that plan hinted at on the data page back in Rise of the Powers of X number 1. So a pretty quick change of plans here, but we don't need to drag it out any longer. He does wipe Moira's memory with this incident, saying, "I'm hoping you will make the right decision in the end, that you think of something other than yourself." And then he says, "Listen, Moira," another callback to their bench scene. And this is when he does the mind wipe, but I'm thinking maybe he's also implanting some kind of a memory or a message to come out in the future.
Yes.
You get that as well?
Yes. I actually kind of rolled my eyes when I was like, "I hope you make the right decision." It seems like he's taking away free will, that he's just putting a, you know, mental thing in her brain. Yeah, and then trying to rationalize it to himself is like, "Oh, I hope you make the right choice."
Well, we'll have to see what it is, right? If it's just like a message that comes out at a certain time and thinking back on that, she decides of her own free will to do something different. That could be all right. But, Charles and free will.
I'm going to retcon whatever I see into him.
Oh, wow.
Having forced her decision at this point in time.
Very skeptical. So skeptical. And by the way, this is only the first mind wipe we get to see in this week's comics. There's going to be another one coming up. It's a big mind wipe issue, mind wipe week. So Xavier and Moira leave, and it's kind of like this incident never happened. Xavier even says the Madrox-infused Sinisters are designed to dissolve via zero fluid. Zero fluid for a throwaway
line. I don't know
what
a zero fluid is, but it's whatever. I mean, it doesn't bother me that much.
I Googled it, of course, and zero fluid is what gives Jack of Hearts his power, which nothing mutant related, as far as I can tell at all, with zero fluid. But you could have put any words there, blah, 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 dissolve via whatever.
And
I guess that's a good enough callback as any.
Probably just Karen Gillan giving himself a pat on the back because he probably likes Jack of Hearts.
Maybe. I've never heard him talk about Jack of Hearts, but that's fine. I mean, the only time I've really seen Jack of Hearts, I'm not an old school Avengers reader, so I have to go back and read the original Jack of Hearts bit someday. But he was in that She-Hulk book that was going on for a while. That was basically a romance comic between him and She-Hulk. And so I did hear about the zero fluid in that run, but that's all I know about Jack of Hearts.
Yeah, Kurt Busiek is also a big Jack of Hearts stan. He's always talking about it, which I don't know why. I'm just wondering if maybe it's a character that's in the industry favorite.
Well, I think that might have been from his Avengers run. Could be. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so now, leaving Jack of Hearts behind, the crew is back inside the No Place, and it's pretty uncomfortable. Everybody knows that Doug is really Sinister. Now, Sinister's happy because he thinks, oh, I don't have to pretend to be that goody-two-shoes Doug Ramsey anymore. Not that he was ever trying all that hard. And pretending's not the only thing he won't have to do much longer, because Rasputin asks, and Xavier agrees, and she just kills Sinister. Big old sword right through the gut.
Yes.
Very striking.
Charles is not.
Wow.
Yeah, Charles is I don't know. No loyalty with Charles.
Yes,
basically.
No, I mean, with all that time he spent with this version of Sinister, who was kind of pathetic and asking for help and living inside his head, found a new body, no emotional connection, just, okay, I guess we don't need him anymore. You don't want him around. I guess Rasputin is more important to him than Sinister.
Yeah.
And clearly, they can't both coexist. So she gets to kill Sinister. I did love this art. It has this nice kind of echo in the background with its silhouette on this orange background. Looks really fantastic. Thought it was great. For instance, much more dramatic than, say, I don't know, Dr. Stasis's death at that tiny airport at the other side of this event, right? Where that just kind of felt like, you know, lame ending of a cool character. This was truly shocking. Did not expect it. And we're going to get another shock to come just one page turn later.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, there'll be a Sinister in the future, right? He's too big of a character to forever get rid of. But I guess this is the on-panel death of the snarky Sinister, right? So I guess it's a liberty for whoever writes him next to
take
a different type of Sinister.
We have the other Sinister offshoots, or the other Nathan Essex is hanging around, especially Enigma. But yeah, this could be the end of that particular take on Mr. Sinister until, you know, somebody decides to do it again down the road.
I mean, I always say this, but if nothing else, you've got Bar Sinister, right? There's got to be a clone somewhere that can just...
So many clones.
Yeah, take over. But
yeah, any writer could always decide they want Mr. Sinister to be written any particular way. And oh, there's a clone who does that. So that could be fun too. So now that they've taken care of their whole Sinister problem, Rachel and Xavier bring up that third plan again. Xavier calls the alternative plan worse. So much worse and more unlikely, but he agrees to try it. The plan is to resurrect the Phoenix, which we've heard that talked about in the past, right? That's what Rachel has mentioned. And on the page turn, we learn that step one of this plan is kill Rachel.
Yeah, that shocked me. I mean, but also, like, this Xavier is such a jerk. Again, rationalizing, he's like, oh, I know it's too late to say this, but I'm sorry. And then he shoots her. Come on, Charles.
Much, much quicker than he did with Moira, right? No long talk, no, oh, feel bad for me, just a quick, I'm sorry, and just shoots her with that same gun, clean through her, right, in the back, shoots her in the back, it comes out the chest. I mean, technically, we don't see that Rachel is fully dead, but, I mean, that blast through the chest, the blank look on her face, imply it really strongly. So what do you think the plan is here? Why do they have to kill Rachel? Or plan three, which may or may not really be to bring back the Phoenix, probably is. Why do you think they have to shoot Rachel?
Anytime it's with somebody who was a Phoenix, I assume it has to do with Phoenix. Maybe you kill Rachel and somehow that causes the Phoenix Force to manifest in her and bring her back. I don't know.
Well, what I'm thinking is, what happens to the Phoenix when it dies?
Yeah, rebirth, right?
Where does it go? Yeah. Where does it go?
The White Hot Room.
White Hot Room. So I'm thinking maybe he's just sending Rachel to the White Hot Room and maybe connecting there with Jean and the other things going on there.
Interesting.
Maybe that's my best guess is it's trying to connect these two sides of things. Because we don't see the White Hot Room people in this issue. We don't see, you know, Hope and Exodus and all those folks. We only see this side of things. So maybe next issue we're going to get
more. I'm totally down for that. I like it. And I'm laughing at the same time because... This is definitely, I understand why this would be the worst of the plans, which is like, I don't know, some Phoenix stuff.
Yeah, if
when you're backed up against the wall, I was like, I've got these plans, I think this should work. Phoenix, right?
Like, yeah, as a reader,
what do you mean with the Phoenix? Just,
too, yeah.
Just get it to the Phoenix, the White Out Room, let's see what happens. It usually fixes shit.
Yeah, it's like Speed Force. You just say Speed Force and, oh, there's something wrong with the Speed Force. There's something wrong with the Phoenix. Oh, how do we fix it? More Phoenix. Okay.
Also, it's like a meta. Like, I wonder if I would assume the writers would kind of laugh about that, right?
Could
they would
be,
just
yeah.
be like, when you paint yourself into a corner in X-Men world, you just do a Phoenix subplot.
Right, just like the readers, we want another plan to happen too. I tried, guys. Hey, I'm Kieran Gillen. I tried to come up with a way to solve this that wasn't the Phoenix, but they tied my hands. I got to go Phoenix. There's nothing left. Oh, well. We do have a little more to talk about this issue because going back and forth with this story, we have a conversation between Nimrod and evil robot Moira. Remember, the cliffhanger last issue was Enigma making contact with evil robot Moira, telling her, they don't win, I win, followed by, let's talk. And in this issue, yeah, they do talk. The very first thing we learn of note is that the trickster Dominion that sent Omega Sentinel to this timeline was Enigma. And we even get an attempt to clean up the whole Titan versus Dominion confusion.
Yeah, I thought this was something that you must be happy about.
That the Enigma Dominion was pretending to be a trickster Titan. Now, what Enigma would have gained by this pretense? Maybe just hiding his identity? Oh, it's a Titan, not a Dominion? I'm not quite sure why he had to hide it. But that's the explanation. Good on Kieran Gillen for trying to clean things up, I think. I do think it was a mistake that they're trying to clear up. That's what it comes across as. Anyway.
Yeah, it did not seem intentional, despite what they lead us to believe.
But we have an answer now, and I'm cool with that. Enigma's main goal, presumably, was to create Orcus, speed up the conflict against Krakoa, generally bring about the various timelines that resulted in the whole Enigma-Dominion creation. And this Moira-Enigma partnership would be an odd one. We're told that without Moira, Enigma is trapped inside this timeline and its dependents. But with Moira on board, Enigma would be able to travel to the timelines of her previous lives as well. And There's some questions here. Like, why is this? I mean, Rachel can send the dead X-Men to all those other timelines. And she's powerful, but she's not a Dominion. Axe Moira from Dead X-Men can use her axe to go to these other timelines just by collecting some, you know, various fetch quest materials, and she can do that.
Fetch quest material.
But Enigma, a friggin' Dominion can't go there? That seems implausible. I did some looking around, and the best I've come up with is that over in Defenders Beyond, right, that Al Ewing book where Enigma first appeared, and maybe you can give me more context on this. I just kind of looked up a little bit. There's this group called the Beyonders, and they're doing something to keep Enigma contained to a subset of realities. Do you think this is like a back door for Enigma to escape from these confines by going through Moira's own mind to get to those other lifetimes?
That's interesting. Yeah, maybe. I don't even remember that part. And I read Defenders Beyond. It wasn't really very highlighted.
I didn't write down the issue number, but it is, yeah. So I'm wondering if he's not really so interested in these other lifetimes for their own sake, but maybe it's like a tunnel to get him to every reality, and then he can just be run rampant.
Yeah, that's interesting. Works for me.
I'm buying it. Again, I haven't read that whole series, but I want to know what his motivation is, and that's the best one I can come up with. So what would Moira get from this partnership? She'd get the one thing she most wants, true immortality. Enigma says he has growth plans. Yeah, he's already a Dominion, but he wants to be a bigger Dominion. Can never be big enough Dominion. He's going to, quote, absorb all intelligences from this locale in the near future. And we learn now that the absorbed intelligences will no longer have any individual existence, which would be news, I think, to Nimrod, Omega Sentinel. I don't think that's their idea of paradise. I don't think they know about a whole annihilation of the self sort of
thing. I think they were thinking they were like in a city, right? Outside time and space.
Right.
Being invited to join the corporation.
Maybe junior partners, but partners.
Yeah, exactly.
Enigma promises Moira that, hey, join my team right here and, quote, you will be a fully independent subroutine in my endless engine, a coherent titan inside me. Again, doesn't sound like my idea of paradise to be a subroutine, but, you know, she's already a robot, so maybe that's the best she can get.
Yeah. I'd also be suspicious of, like, for both public sides, crossing. Right? Like, yeah, would you really want to invite Moira into your empire with the option to potentially try to disrupt you, right, and take over? You would just assume that's what she would try to do. And then from Moira's perspective, I'd be like, why would you trust me in any way, right?
We do get some language that says, oh, we Dominions, we have this way of making binding agreements, which, you know, that's common to a lot of fantasy science fiction novels. Oh, you know, you make you swear on this, and that's you can't break that promise.
Yeah.
Which I think that's probably true. I think it makes for a better story if it is true, like a Dominion pinky swear sort of a deal.
Yeah, self-executing
so
contract.
Agrees right then and there. The deal is made, and we get some really cool art of a spiral galaxy appearing in Moira's eye, and then this psychedelic-looking page of 10 stretched-out multicolored Earths representing all those timelines that Moira is now sharing with Enigma. Really great-looking page. And the segment here wraps up with Moira telling Omega Sentinel, hey, good news, a Dominion has made contact. So far, it's true. And then she says, they want to help us. Not exactly true. So many conspiracies. We've already seen all those secrets on Xavier's side. Although I think the truth of I think Xavier's lies are all exposed now. I think we really are on to, you know, that last plan. I don't think he has anything in reserve, though. Xavier, who knows? But on the bad guy side, we now have the AIs conspiring against the human members of Orcus. Now we have Moira and Enigma conspiring against the AIs. Some complicated, cool stuff. I really like it. To wrap up, another excellent issue from Kieran Gillen. Big ideas rooted in solid character moments, solid motivations. We found a pretty good explanation for why Enigma might need Moira. We'll see how much we learn about that going forward. And yeah, I've already raved about the art. Besides the young Moira scenes, Death of Sinister, that moment where the deal is struck between Moira and Enigma, it looks great, and it really tells the reader, hey, something majorly transformative has just occurred. This is a moment to remember. And yeah, this is a book that feels like an event, and I can't wait for this, the next issue of Kieran Gillen's epic to come out. So looking ahead, we have 3 Jerry Duggan weeks before our next Kieran Gillen week.
God.
But we'll make it through, Ruben. We'll get there. We have
just
this to
remember,
look forward to.
Yes, this is. There will be
the
another issue.
The end of the tunnel. So yeah, I'm giving this issue maybe generous, but I'm in a great mood now. I love this book. 9 out of 10. really good stuff.
Yeah, I'm giving it a 9 too. The biggest criticism I saw about this issue was somebody saying they hated, I think it was Matt Razor saying that he hates Xavier with a beard. But I don't think this is an Xavier you're supposed to like, right? I mean, I think this is, Xavier being a jerk is kind of a trope at this point, but this is showing him as kind of a jerk, right? But it's an interesting jerk. Like, I get why he's doing what he's doing. It's just, you're just like, oh man, Xavier, you're
that. It's the culmination of the kind of jerk he's been now for these past 5 years. So he better be a jerk now. If he was suddenly, you know, a really super nice guy, just trying to be all, you know, flowers and bunny rabbits, Easter motif there, it wouldn't be true. It wouldn't be true to the character. So he better be this kind of a jerk. And this is a good version of that kind of a jerk.
Yeah, I thought it was just really good. All around solid issue. And like you said, art's great, story's great. There were moments where I was like, what? How did that happen? Even the sort of making fun of the Phoenix, like meta critique, it works for me. So yeah, definitely 9 out of 10.
All right. Moving on to our next issue this week, which is Wolverine number 46, Sabretooth War Part 6, Bad Memories. So now that's 2 issues in a row where the chapter gets its own title. Oh, well, that's fine by me. Just, I'm always curious when they change. Oh, we're just going to be part this, and now they decide out of the blue, yeah, let's give them titles. It is written by Ben Percy and Victor Laval, pencils by Corey Smith, inks by Oren Jr. We've been going back and forth on the artist team here. These colors are by Alex Sinclair, letters by Corey Pettit. And once again, this chapter catches us up on the whereabouts of 3 separate sets of characters. Although 2 sets do come together before this chapter is over. These sets are, we have Logan, Sabretooth, and Quentin's Head on Krakoa. We have the Exiles working on tracking down Sabretooth. And we have Laura imprisoned on Orcus Station 5. Now, 2 more groups we don't get to see this issue are those other 2 Sabretooth who are plotting against Victor Creed. We don't see what was messed up with Victor Creed's father's face. Get that maybe next issue. We also don't get to see the rest of the gang left behind at Krakoa further north. Maybe we'll get to them again next issue as well. So let's start off with Laura. Ladies first, you know, at least for now. And she has a pretty small scene in this issue, so it's clean to get her deal out of the way first. She's still in that clear box of a cell on Orcus Station 5. She had her face all torn up a few issues back, but she's looking much better now. She is Wolverine after. And she's up to something. When one of those headless, mindless one-looking Sabretooth bots brings her food, she first pretends to be sleeping and then attacks it, hacking it to bloody bits. 2 more headless saber bots come in to subdue her, but in the chaos, Laura manages to hold on to that electronic control disc, looks like a Roomba, that she hacked off of the original saber bot. I think what's going on here is we got some color change bits of lights that I think this can unlock her cell. So I'm thinking she's going to use this to escape, right? At one point, you see it approach, and the light turns green, and the door opens, and then it goes in, and the light turns red again, and it closes. So I think this is just an escape key.
That makes sense. I was wondering what the heck that was. I mean, it was a cool moment, but I didn't necessarily need to understand it. But I was like, huh, I don't know what you're going to do with that. But good job. You got what you wanted.
So we'll see more from her next time, I'm sure. Meanwhile, on Krakoa, we know that Sabretooth and Quentin has mind-freaked Logan into thinking that he's back in his old Weapon X days, going on a mission with his own pal Victor. I really like the way this story is presented. In one set of panels, generally on the left half of the page, we readers get to see what's really happening. These 2 are on Krakoa in the present day. They use Krakoa tech to go scuba diving down into a trench to get to a hidden section of Forge's lab to retrieve a very particular gun. Another set of panels, outlined in pink and usually on the right side of the page, show what Logan thinks is happening. He thinks that he and Victor are back in their old uniforms, and they're skydiving into enemy territory to secure possession of dangerous weapons and, quote, keep them out of the wrong paws. Pause, a little too cutesy there, but okay, that's fine. Quentin is still trying to resist Victor's commands. For instance, when Victor tells him to shut his hole, Quentin deliberately doesn't warn Victor about a volley of missiles headed their way. Now, for me, the parallelism of these sets of panels is the most interesting thing about this issue. We see Logan's mind, under Quentin's influence, turn scuba into skydiving, fish into birds, sea anemones into vines, which reminds me very strongly of another comic I've read, which is Detective Comics number 719 from 1998. I don't suppose that number rings any bells to
you. No.
Okay. Let me tell you about it. That issue was written by Chuck Dixon, was the prelude issue to the Cataclysm storyline, the one with the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
In Detective 719, a criminal named Morg Tice tells a group of other prisoners the story about his run-in with Batman. Morg's version of events goes down one side of the page, while the actual events, painting a rather less badass version of Morg's doings, go down the other side of the page. So I love it when a technique like this takes full advantage of the comic format to do something you really couldn't do quite the same way in any other format. So good stuff. And I don't know that Percy and Company are directly inspired by that 26-year-old Batman story, but the technique works great here, too. By the way, that story, I learned about that by listening to our old buddy Chris's podcast about the Cataclysm, No Man's Land. So, hey, listeners, when you're done with us, if you want to hear some more Batman stuff, you know, go to your podcatcher and enter Cosmic Treadmill, and you can hear some cool Batman podcasts. Anyway, enough Batman. Creed and Logan do make it down into this hidden section of Forge's lab, with Creed taunting Logan the whole way about all the awful things Logan has done over the years. How many people he's killed, how many families made bereaved, just really laid it on thick. Inside the lab, the two are attacked by another set of Forge's mechanical guardians, this time being stone golems that, to me, look like very Jack Kirby-inspired. That special gun Sabretooth is after is here, but he's having difficulty getting his hands on it. Ruben, by the way, we did see a picture of this gun way back at the beginning. Did you recognize that gun right away, or, like me, did you just not get it until the ending?
Yeah, I didn't get it till they explained that it was a Forge gun. It was one from Inferno, right?
It's one that's been around for a while. It's the depowering gun. The same one he used on Storm way, way back in
Lightfall. On Storm 2? Okay.
Yeah. And that also was the one that got used to depower Moira. So, yeah, it is a distinctive design, and it's been around for a long time now. So, if you're paying attention, like I wasn't, you would be able to tell right away what Sabretooth is after. But if not, it does get pointed out. So, we're going to leave this group here for a moment, head off to see what the Exiles are up to. Last issue, we saw them approach Krakoa, but then have to run away with their tail between their legs when a Stark Sentinel came after them. This group hasn't learned a thing, because they just come back around and approach the island again. Oya, now she's one of the Exiles, she's no dummy, she knows it's a bad plan, but Necra's kind of in charge, I guess. She insists. She even shoots these pathetic weapons from the ship at the Sentinels, weapons that the ship itself tells her will have no effect. I mean, I guess there is an effect. It just lets all the Sentinels on the island know about them, and like a dozen Sentinels just start shooting at this ship. So the ship dives into the water for protection, and I guess none of the Sentinels follow this time? That, I thought, was a plot hole. The last time, one Sentinel followed it all the way out into space, but no Sentinel just dives under the water. I mean, Sentinels can go in water, right? That's not their one weakness we haven't talked about.
That would be something if the Sentinels just weren't waterproof.
Yeah, they should have followed. It doesn't make any sense that they have, oh, here's this one ship attacking the island. Oh, now it's in the water. Forget about it. Go back to what we were doing. But they need to get this ship under the water, because once underwater, Oya gets a second psychic message from her old flame Quentin that tells her, you know, where they are down in the trench, got a scuba dive. A lot of scuba diving this week. I don't know. Seems to be a theme. They put on these scuba suits. They get attacked by the same sea anemones. The Exile named Melter saves them with his heat powers. And this scene is only here to remind us that Melter exists, because he's about to be killed off. The Exiles find their way into the lab while the fight with the stone golems is still going on. And Toad, hey, remember Toad? Toad uses his disgusting tongue to snag that special gun. He points the gun at Creed, but I guess Toad's reaction time isn't great, because before Toad can pull the trigger, Sabretooth just runs across the room at him, rips his arm clean off.
Yeah, that surprised me. I was like, I don't know if Toad is surviving that.
Oh, yeah, Toad is not surviving that. I'm pretty sure Toad bleeds to death in this issue. I think he's gone. Rip Mortimer Toynbee. Yes, I had to look up what Toad's real name is, but it is Mortimer Toynbee. Or was. Quentin tries to take advantage of the chaos of the battle to return Logan to reality, but before he can do that, Logan does another bad thing he's going to feel bad about. He uses his claws to murder Melter to death. R.I.P. Christopher Colchis. That's Melter's real name. Logan wakes up with Melter's guts still clinging to his claws and generally feels pretty awful about it. Now, Logan's about to feel even worse because Sabretooth takes that gun, Forge's depowering gun, and shoots Logan with it, which means bye-bye healing factor. As the issue ends, Sabretooth runs at Logan with murderous intent. So that was his plan the whole Well, I don't know about the whole time, because I don't know when Sabretooth learned about this gun. Probably not until after he had Quentin, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, if it's a gun that's been around, maybe he just knows that this is a thing. But
could be. Maybe he knows it's a thing. Maybe he needed Quentin to know where it was. That could work.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe this was his plan the whole time, and just exactly the details of it had to emerge along the way. So yeah,
it did surprise me, though. I was really surprised that was the sort of like outcome.
Yeah, there's a nice cliffhanger there.
Yeah, and there was a lot of good conversations about with Quentin being like, "Oh, you actually enjoy this, right? You miss him, this and that, right?"
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, "Don't talk to me."
Yeah, they do have this weird relationship where Sabretooth, it seems to like you talk to a guy whose glory days were like playing high school football, and he really wants to go back to those days. It does seem like Sabretooth thinks about those Weapon X days as, you know, when he was really enjoying life, when things were simple, when he just had a good time with his buddies, and he wants to go back there, but he also wants to punish Logan for, you know, all the stuff Logan's done over the years. So, pretty good. Yeah, decent issue. I like the continuity of seeing Forge's depowering gun again. I love that technique of the reality versus hallucination. The exile stuff, that they're just so dumb. What was the plan? You had to get them under the water. I get that. But the way that, whether it was Laval or Percy who got them there, it just wasn't done very well.
Attacking, I also liked that they just got completely shredded by Wolverine. They was like, they had no thought plan. They were badasses, and they kept talking a big game, and I was like, what are you guys expecting? And then they just get wrecked the way I expected they would get wrecked.
But the plan was, right, they have this death seed, killing seed thing that Doug gave them.
Yeah.
But why don't they use it right away? Shouldn't have been, oh, we see he's right here in front of us. Here it is. Ka-ching. Make it happen. But they don't. So I got to dig it for that. But, you know, again, a perfectly fine issue. It is being a very violent Wolverine story, just like the cover of the first issue promised. So I got to give this 7.3 out of 10. Pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, I liked it more than that. I'll go 7.8. I thought it was, I don't know. There's something about depowering Wolverine that does raise stakes for me.
Okay.
And that cliffhanger really got me. I was like, oh, wow. Especially since it's such a beloved character. There's not a lot you can do to Wolverine that makes me think like something real has happened to him, and depowering him actually is like a thing. I think that gun, there's not a lot that resets that gun, right? At least from my memory.
Well, I don't remember how Storm got over it, but yeah, Moira has certainly not gotten over it. So, interesting. Moving on to our final issue of the show, and there's my ding sound, which is X-Force number 50, Violent Answers, written also by Ben Percy, art by Robert Gill, colors by Guru Effects, letters by Joe Caramagna, and design by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. This is the final issue of this whole series, and it kind of ends underwhelmingly for me. We had all this buildup of Evil Beast in multiple series. We had that great restaurant scene of him just tearing into lobsters with his bare paws. This ending, well, just kind of happened. So, Ruben, why don't you talk about that while I have some tea and clear my throat?
Specifically the ending. Yeah, he is going to launch his nuclear weapon, and Wonder Man goes down to move it. And
well, I mean, just in general, and I'm back from my tea break. Thank you. I know I threw that at you with no warning. Yeah, just the way that it was this huge concept of, oh, Beast is evil, Beast is evil. How are we going to deal with this? And you hope for a really big dramatic, wow, that's how it finished up. And I did not get that feeling from the end of Evil Beast. Am I expecting too much, or was this kind of a failure to take advantage of that moment?
It didn't seem like a consistent characterization. Like, the outcome just kind of comes out of nowhere, right? Like, he's sacrificed so many of his friends along the way to get to this point, and he talked about how the ends justified the means in every circumstance, and that you're an idiot if you didn't believe that. But then when Wonder Man's life's at risk, he sacrifices himself.
Yeah, why? I guess that's what happened. We'll get to the details, but yeah, you're right that it just kind of, he's saving this character who didn't appear until issue 49 out of 50. And it again, it doesn't feel like there was a huge, well thought out plan for what to do with this Beast. So when we left off last time, Silver Age Beast and his pal Wonder Man had stolen a boat on their way to confront Krakoa Beast. The rest of X-Force were after them, the Bluebird, though they didn't know that Wonder Man was on the boat as well. So as the issue opens, the Bluebird is firing missiles at the boat, Wonder Man decides that, hey, I'm a pacifist. I can't shoot at the Bluebird itself, but I can use these pink beams out of my hands to destroy the missiles. I didn't even know that was a thing Wonder Man could do. I don't know a lot about Wonder Man, but apparently he's basically an energy creature. He can do anything with energy. Kind of, you know, hard to really put a limit on that, but I can buy that he can shoot some missiles. They do end up having to abandon the ship and go into scuba mode, more scuba diving. Ben Percy just has scuba diving all over the place this week. They run into Krakoa Beast right away. Krakoa Beast gets rid of Simon right away, so the two beasts can have this heart-to-heart. So now our story splits into two parts, air and sea. Up in the air, Simon gets picked up by the Bluebird, and there's this air battle between X-Force and some Orcus, you know, people. Which, this bit really feels like filler, right? The title of the book says X-Force, so X-Force has to have something to do in their final issue. The jet is piloted by June Wei, that one Orcus character from the Chronicler arc, and that jet also has some Wolverine skeleton sentinels on it. And then they bring in a Stark Sentinel. X-Force defeats the Wolverine skeletons in two panels. Laura breaks into the jet, defeats June Wei in one panel. The Stark Sentinel battle takes slightly longer, but ends when Sage, quote, hacks into its brain, using Omega Red as like a human USB cable. I mean, so hooray, Omega Red does have something to do with this issue. Zero lines of dialogue once again, but his existence is acknowledged by the other characters, which is better than he's been getting for a while. But yeah, this whole section was, we got to have X-Force do something, right? There's no real tension or drama or anything here.
Yeah.
Generic fight. The real story, the part that Ben Percy is interested in, is taking place at the bottom of the sea. The two beasts have a chat, pretty much exactly what you'd predict. One beast says, oh, you've taken the wrong path, but you must change. The other beast says, no, this is the only way. The ends justify the means. And remember, the means here he's talking about are using Forge's gun, not the depowering gun, the other one, to hide Mars away in a black hole. Then Beast is going to single-handedly defeat Orcus and, I guess, conquer the world? So a little vague central part there, exactly how Beast is going to do that. He is an egotist of the highest order, but still, I don't know what his plan is here. And then they're going to bring Mars back out of the black hole and profit, I guess. So the two beasts end up brawling. Black hole gun gets launched, and when it breaks the surface, Wonder Man's there to try to stop it. And I think what happens here is that Wonder Man destroys the gun's propulsion system. So now it's not going into space, which means that the beast's plan is already finished. It's not this whole send Mars into the black hole. That's not happening. He also sees that the black hole gun's nuclear reactor is about to go critical and explode, which would kill Wonder Man. Probably do a lot of other bad stuff, too. You know, nuclear explosions, not good news. But Beast doesn't care about that. Krakoa Beast, still wearing that Krakoa Tech battle suit he stole from Krakoa further north, he grabs this gun and forces it down to the ocean where it explodes, presumably killing him. Now, some reviewers are saying that this is an ambiguous ending, that we can't be sure which Beast died and which lived. I didn't read it that way at all.
No, it's not ambiguous.
It's very clear which Beast was which.
Yes. I mean,
just from the dialogue. They sound very different. They're drawn the same. You know, once the glasses get broken on Silver Age Beast, they look the same, but they don't sound the same at all. So it's clearly it was the evil Beast who rode that missile down.
Yes.
The only possible ambiguity here is we don't actually see Krakoa Beast get blowed up. Wolverine narration box tells us he was atomized, but it's certainly possible a future writer might conceivably try to reveal that he survived somehow. But as the Krakoan Age ends, Krakoa Beast is off the table. Silver Age Beast is roomies with his old pal Simon and rainy Los Angeles. The final page shows the rest of X-Force return to the greenhouse, a.k.a. Krakoa further north. We get the atomized thing from the narration, and also that June Wei had her mind wiped. Another mind wipe. She was sent back to Orcus. There's a little hand-waving justification that if Orcus finds out X-Force is still around, innocent people will die, so we have to just cover everything up with June Wei. Which I guess is invoking that whole, hey, and if there's any mutants on Earth, we Orcas are going to kill 10 humans? Which is a rule that we've completely forgotten about in every other book, but technically still a thing, and Ben Percy remembers.
Yes.
Is that what's going on here? That's the only explanation I can come up with.
Yeah, it made me laugh, because I was like, nobody else cares about this rule, but okay.
There we are. And finally, we get the classic, here's the whole team around the table pose to create what's, I guess, supposed to be a satisfying ending. But we know from the editor's note on the credits page that right around the corner here comes Sabretooth. So don't get too comfy in those chairs. A lot of you are going to have a bad time going forward. So a bit of a disappointing ending. The art is good. Robert Gill continues to give us great cartoony expressions and action. The fights lack drama to me, but that's a writing issue, not an art one. And so the longest running title of the Krakoan era comes to an end. 50 issues by one writer is quite an accomplishment. It's too bad that the ending was a dud. I'm going to go down to a 5.5 out of 10. Just kind of disappointed. How about you?
Yeah, I'm a little more positive than that. I'll give it a 6. But I was kind of bored. I just was like, okay, this is how it ends. Sort of generic, and the, you know, the Dark Beast, the new Dark Beast was like, just kind of fizzled, right? That story really just
went nowhere. That's why I gave it a particularly low score, is because it should be so much bigger. This is the final issue. Issue number 50, wrapping up this whole title, this whole team, this whole Dark Beast storyline that we've been talking about for literally years. And to just have it just kind of be a wet fart of an ending was just disappointing.
Yeah. It kind of makes you just think, like, there really was no point to having Dark Beast.
Well, it was a cool idea, but there was never any plan for how you're going to finish it up at the end, right? How are we going to reset and make Beast an okay character to use again? I mean, Chris and I were talking about this way, way back in, you know, episode 1, 2 of this podcast. So they knew that they were going to have to come up with a way to make this usable going forward, and I think they could have done it. All right, those are all the books that we are talking about this week. Next week, we have really just 2 books, I think. So kind of a lighter week for you and me, Ruben. I'm not too sorry about that. We have X-Men number 33, back to the Jerry Duggan side of things. And we have Avengers number 12. That is, on the cover, it says, a Fall of the House of X tie-in. Also a chance for us to preview how Jed McKay, the writer of Avengers, might write these X characters going forward. So I'm going to have to do some reading to kind of get caught up on Avengers and see what's going on. And then we're going to talk about Avengers number 12 next week. There's also Deadpool number 1 coming out next week. And Deadpool's kind of an X-Men adjacent character. But I think he's probably splitting off from the whole X-Men thing. I think he's going to be more on the Avengers side of things, his own side of things. This is the series that's written by Cody Ziegler. And I know Jim already kind of previewed this on one of his YouTube shows. So we'll let Jim handle the Cody Ziegler Deadpool going. Sound good, Ruben?
That sounds great. I don't particularly like Deadpool.
Well, on that happy note, Ruben, what do you think our loyal listeners might do until they get to hear about X-Men and Avengers next week?
Read more X-Men comics.
Bye-bye, everybody.